Why would the vision thing make such a difference? Depth perception defines a three-dimensional space filled with movable solid objects. Color makes objects pop out from their backgrounds and gives us a sensation that corresponds to... Color makes objects filled with movable solid objects. Thing makes such a difference. Together, they have pushed the primate brain into splitting the flow of visual information into two states. Color makes objects pop out from their and their shapes and compositions, and a aware system for their locations and motions. It can't be a coincidence that the human mind grasps the world, even the most abstract ethereals. It can't be a coincidence. It can't face films that the human mind went from being sick to being well, even if he didn't move an inch. He could have been in bed the whole time. Mary can give him many pieces of advice, even if they merely talked on the phone and nothing changed hands. Even scientists, when they try to grasp abstract mathematical relationships, plot them in graphs that show them as two- and three-dimensional shapes. Our capacity for abstract thought has co-opted the coordinate system and inventory of objects made available. It is harder to see how a standard mammal could have moved in that direction. Hugged the ground, sniffing the rich chemical tracks and trails left behind by other living things. Most mammals hug the ground, sniffing the rich chemical phantasmagoria on a sidewalk. Knows that it lives in an olfactory world beyond lives in an old. Here is an exaggerated way of stating the difference. Rather than living in a three-dimensional coordinate space hung with dimmable objects, standard mammals live in a two-dimensional flatland, which they explore through a three-dimensional peak. Movable objects. Edwin Abbott's flat mammals live in a two-dimensional. Showed that a two-dimensional world differs from our own in ways other than just lacking one-third of the usual dimensions. Many geometric arrangements are simply impossible. A full-faced human figure has no way of getting food into his mouth, and a profiled one would be divided into two pieces by his digestive tract. Most mammals think in a cognitive flatland. They would lack the mental models of movable solid, the mental 3D spatial and mechanical relationships that became so essential to our mental life. A second possible prerequisite, this one found in the common ancestor of humans, chimpanzees, and gorillas, is group living. Most apes and monkeys are gregarious, though most mammals are not. Living together has advantages. A cluster of animals is not much more detectable to a predator than a single animal, and if it is detected, the likelihood that any individual will be picked off is diluted. Drivers feel less vulnerable speeding when they are in a group of speeders because chances are the traffic cop will stop someone else. A second advantage is in foraging efficiency. The advantage is most in cooperative hunting of large animals, such as in wolves and lions, but it also helps in sharing and defending other ephemeral food resources too big to be consumed by the individual who found it, such as a tree laden with ripe fruit, or vulnerable to predators, tend to hang out in groups. Groupless stage for the evolution of human-like intelligence in two ways. With a group already in place, the value of having better information is multiplied, because information is the one commodity that can be given away and kept at the same time. A smarter animal living in a group enjoys a commodity that can be given whatever it can get in trade for the knowledge. The other way in which a group is a crucible of intelligence is that group living itself possesses new cognitive challenges. There are also disadvantages to them. There are also neighbors compete over food, water, mates, and nest sites. And they're adding crowd. Neighbors compete at risk of exploitation. Over food, water, and if baboons were philosophers, no doubt they would say that hell is other baboons. Social animals risk theft, cannibalism, cuckoldry, infanticide, extortion, and other treachery. Every social creature is poised between milking the benefits and suffering the costs of group living. That creates a pressure to stay on the right side of the ledger by becoming smarter. In many kinds of animals, the largest-brained and smartest-behaving species are social. Sea lions, and of course monkeys, gorillas, and chimpanzees. The orangutans. solitary is a puzzling exception. Social animals send and receive signals. Smart but also solitary is a puzzle. Smart but also solitary is an exception. Access. They exchange favors, repay and enforce debts, punish cheaters, or join coalitions. The collective expression for humanoids, a shrewdness of apes, tells a story. Primates are sneaky, bald-faced liars. They hide from rivals' eyes to flirt, cry wolf. Primates are sneaky, bald-faced. Primates are sneaky, bald-faced liars. Chimpanzees monitor one another's goals, at least crudely, and sometimes appear to use them in pedagogy and deception. One chimp, shown a set of boxes with food and one with a snake, led his companions to the snake, led his creaming, feasted in peace. Vervet monkeys are yentas who keep close track after they fled screaming, feasted in peace, after they fled comings and goings and friends peace. World, that they ignore the tracks of a python and the ominous sight of a carcass in a tree, the sight of the work of a leopard. Several theorists have proposed that the human brain is the outcome of a cognitive arms race, is the outcome of a cognitive Machiavellian intelligence of our primate forebears. There's only so much brain power you need to subdue a plant or a rock, the argument goes, but the other guy is about as smart as you are and may use that intelligence against your interests. You had better think about what he is thinking, about what you are thinking he is thinking. As far as brain power goes, there's no end to keeping up with the Joneses. My own guess is that a cognitive arms race by itself was not enough to launch human intelligence. Except ours has, probably because without some other change in lifestyle, some other intelligence, brain size, extended childhood, and so on, would damp the positive feedback loop. Humans are exact loop, biological, not just social intelligence. In a species that runs optional in mechanical and biological, optional in mechanical, each faculty, not just socially, the expansion of the human brain is no evolutionary freak crying out for a runaway positive, crying out for. The brain tripled in size in 5 million years, but that is leisurely by evolutionary timekeeping. There was enough time in homekeeping for the brain to shoot up to human size, shrink back down, and shoot up again several times over. Did evolution for the brain to shoot up to human. A third pilot of its size, hand. Primates evolved in trees and have hands to grasp the branches. Hands to grasp. These use all four limbs to run along the tops of branches, but apes hang from them, mainly by their arms. They have put their well-developed hands to use in manipulating objects. Gorillas meticulously dissect tough or thorny plants to use in manipulating objects. Gorilla mites, rocks to bash open nuts, and mashed leaves to sponge up water. As Samuel Johnson said about dogs walking on their hind legs, while it is not done well, you are surprised to find it done at all. Hands are levers of influence on the world that make intelligence worth having. Precision hands and precision intelligence co-evolved in the human lineage, and the fossil record shows that hands led the way. Finely tooled hands are useless if you have to walk on them all the time. That hands led. Every bone in our bodies has been reshaped to give us our upright posture, which frees the hands for carrying and manipulating. Once again, we have our ape ancestors to thank. Hanging from hands for carrying and manipulating. Trees calls for a body plan that is different. Once again, apes' bodies are already tilted upward with arms that differ from their legs, and chimpanzees and even monkeys walk upright for short distances to carry food and objects. Fully upright posture may have evolved under several selection pressures. Bipedal walking is a biomechanically efficient evolved under several selection pressures way to retool a tree-hanging body. Upright posture also allows one to peer over grass like a marmot. Hominids go out in the midday sun. This zoologically unusual work shift brought in several human adaptations for keeping cool, such as hairlessness and profuse sweating. Upright posture may be another. It is the opposite, such as hairlessness and profuse of lying down to get a tan, profuse sweating, crucial inducements. With the hands free, tools could be assembled out of materials from different locations and brought to where they were most useful, and food and children could be carried to safe or productive areas. A final usher of intelligence was hunting. Hunting, tool use, and bipedalism were for Darwin the special trinity that powered human evolution. Man the Hunter was the major archetype in both serious and pop accounts through the 1960s. But the macho image that resonated with the decade of John Glenn and James Bond lost its appeal in the feminist-influenced Small Planet of the 1970s. A major problem for Man the Hunter was that it credited the growth of intelligence to the teamwork and foresight needed by... A major problem for Man the Hunter was that it credited of both sexes. Women did not wait in the kitchen to cook the mastodon that Dad brought them, nor did they forego the expansion of intelligence enjoyed by evolving men. The ecology of modern foraging peoples suggests that woman the gatherer provided a substantial portion of the calories in the form of highly processed plant food. And that requires mechanical provided a substantial in a group living species, social intelligence is as important a weapon as spears and clubs. But Tooby and DeVore have argued that hunting was nonetheless a major force in human evolution. The key is to ask not what the mind can do for hunting, but what hunting can do for the mind. Hunting provides sporadic not what the mind can do for hunting, packages of concentrated nutrients, but what hunting can natural material for building animal flesh is animal flesh. Though plant foods supply calories and other nutrients, meat is a complete protein containing all 20 amino acids and provides energy-rich fat and indispensable fatty acids. Across the mammals, carnivores have larger brains for their body size than herbivores. Partly because meat can better feed ravenous brain tissue. Even in the most conservative estimates, meat makes up a far greater proportion of foraging humans' diet than of any other primates. That may have been one of the reasons we could afford our expensive brains. Chimpanzees collectively hunt small animals like monkeys and bush pigs, so our common ancestor probably hunted as well. The move to the savannah must have made hunting more appealing. Have few large animals. Only so much solar energy falls on a patch of ground, and if the biomass it supports is locked up in wood, it is not available to make animals. Grasslands can feed vast herds of herbivores, who in turn feed carnivores. Evidence of butchery appears in the fossil record almost 2 million years ago, the time of Homo habilis. Hunting must be even older, since we know that chimpanzees do it, and their activities would not leave evidence in the fossil record. Once our ancestors increased the chimpanzees to thirst during the winter at higher altitudes and latitudes, but hunters can survive there. There are no vegetarian Eskimos. Our ancestors have sometimes been characterized as meek scavengers rather than brave hunters, in keeping with today's machismo-puncturing ethos. But while hominids may occasionally have scavenged, they probably could not have made a living from it, an ethos, with scavenging because they can scan large territories for carcasses and flee on short notice when more formidable competitors show up. Otherwise, scavenging is not for the faint of heart. A carcass is jealously guarded by its hunter or an animal fierce enough to have stolen it. It is attractive to microorganisms, who quickly poison the meat to repel other would-be scavengers. So when modern primates or hunter-gatherers come across a carcass, they usually leave it alone. In a poster widely available in head shops in the early 1970s, one vulture says to the other, "Patience my ass, I'm going to kill something." The poster got it right, except for the vulture part. Mammals that do scavenge, such as hyenas. Social life. Imagine a cow who tries to win the favors of a neighbor by dropping a clump of grass at its feet. One could forgive the second cow for thinking, "Thanks, but I can get my own grass." The nutritional jackpot of a felled animal is another matter. Miss Piggy once advised, "Never eat anything bigger than you can lift." A hunter with a dead animal, large as Piggy once advised, is faced with a unique opportunity. Hunting is largely a matter of luck. In the absence of refrigeration, a good place to store meat for leaner times is in the bodies of other hunters who will return the favor when fortunes reverse. This eases the way for the male coalitions and the extensive reciprocity that are ubiquitous in foraging. Male coalitions surplus. Having concentrated food to offer one's offspring changes the relative payoffs for males between investing in their young and competing with other males for access to females. The robin bringing a worm to the nestlings reminds us that most animals that provision their young do so with prey, the only food that repays the effort to obtain it and reminds us that most animals that provision their young support it. Young do so with prey. In all foraging societies, presumably including our ancestors, hunting is overwhelmingly a male activity. Women are encumbered with children, which makes hunting inconvenient, and men are bigger and more adept at killing because of their evolutionary history of killing each other. As a result, males can invest surplus meat in their children by provisioning the children's pregnant or nursing mothers. They also can trade meat with females for plant foods or for sex. Brazen bartering of the carnal for the carnal has been observed in baboons and carnal has been observed in baboons and plant foods or for though people in modern societies are ever so more discreet, an exchange of resources for sexual access is still an important part of the interactions between men and women all over the world. In any case, sexual access is still an important part. We have not lost the association, the interactions between datingly correct behavior advises. There are three possible parts to a date, of which at least two must be offered: entertainment, food, and affection. It is customary to begin a series of dates with a great deal of entertainment, a moderate amount of food, and the merest suggestion of affection. As the amount of affection increases, entertainment, a moderate amount of food, and the entertainment can be reduced proportionally. Merest suggestion, we no longer call it dating. Under no circumstances can the food be omitted. Of course, no one really knows whether these four habits formed the base camp for the ascent of human intelligence. And no one knows whether there are other untried gradients to intelligence in biological design space. And no one knows whether... But if these traits do explore our other untried million to follow that route, it would have sobering implications for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. A planet with life may not be enough of a launching pad. Its history might have to include a nocturnal predator, to get stereo vision, with descendants that switched to a diurnal lifestyle, for color, in which they depended upon fruit and were vulnerable to predators, for group living, which then changed their means of locomotion to swinging beneath branches, for hands and for precursors to upright position, before a climate shift sent them from the forest into grasslands, for upright pop to grasslands, for upright pot to upright position, years before our brains billowed out, some descendure and hunting. And common ancestor of chimpanzee. Million 20s, that discovery came as a shock to human chauvinists who imagined that our glorious brains led us up the ladder, perhaps as our ancestors decided at each rung what use to make of their newfound smarts. But natural selection could not have worked that way. Why bulk up your brain if you can't put it to use? The history could not have worked that way. Why of paleoanthropology is the bulk up your brain if the most recent discoveries put it at 4 or even 4.5 million years ago? With hands free, subsequent species ratchet upward, click by click, in the features that distinguish us. The dexterity of hands, the sophistication of tools, the dependence on hunting, the size of brains, the range of habitat. Hands, the sophistication of tools... The teeth and jaw become the dependence on muzzle-like. The brow ridges that anchor the muscles that close the jaw shrink and disappear. Our delicate faces differ from the brutes because tools and technology have taken over from teeth. We slaughter and skin animals with blades and soften plants and meats with fire. That eases the mechanical demand. Skin animals with blades and soft on the jaw from our already heavy heads. The sexes come to differ less in size, suggesting that males spent less of their resources beating each other up, and perhaps more on their children and the children's mothers. The stepwise growth of the brain, propelled by hands and feet and manifested in tools, butchered bones, and increased range, is good evidence, if evidence were needed, that intelligence is a product of natural selection for exploitation of the cognitive niche. The package was not an inexorable unfact of natural selection for exploitation of the cognitive every epoch to occupy slightly different niches. Nut-cracking and root-gnawing australopithecines, perhaps one of the two habiline subtypes, quite possibly the Asian branches of australopithecines, perhaps archaic sapiens, one of the two Each species might have been outcompeted when a neighboring, more sapiens-like population had entered far enough into the cognitive niche to duplicate the species' more specialized feats and do much else besides. The package was also not the gift of a macro mutation or random drift. For how could such luck of package was also not the gift of a package one lineage for millions of macro mutation species after bigger brain species. Moreover, the bigger brains were no mere ornaments, but allowed their owners to make finer tools and infest more of the planet. According to the standard timetable in paleoanthropology, the human brain evolved to its modern form in a window that began with the appearance of Homo habilis. Paleoanthropology, the human brain 2 million years ago, evolved to its Homo sapiens sapiens between 200,000 and 100,000 years ago. I suspect that our ancestors were penetrating the cognitive niche for far longer than that. Both ends of the R&D process might have to be stretched beyond the textbook dates, providing even more time for our fantastic mental adaptations to have evolved. At one end of the timetable is the 4 million year old Australopithecines-like afarensis, the species of the charismatic fossil called Lucy. They are often described as chimpanzees with upright posture because their brain size was in the chimpanzee ballpark and that implies that cognitive evolution did not begin till they left no clear evidence of tool use. They left no years later when larger came by chipping choppers. But that can't be right. First, it is ecologically improbable that a tree dweller could have moved onto open ground and retooled its anatomy for upright walking without repercussions on every other aspect of its lifestyle and behavior. Modern chimps, without repercussions on every other use tools and transport objects aspect of its lifestyle freely. Second, though Australopithecines hands retain some the fingers and may have been used at times to run up trees for safety, the hands visibly evolved for manipulation. Compared to chimps' hands, their thumbs are longer and more opposable to the other fingers, and their index. Compared to chimps' hands, middle fingers are angled to allow cupping. Their thumbs are longer. Third, it's not so clear that they had a chimp-sized brain, or that they lacked tools. The paleoanthropologist Yves Copin argues that their brains are 30 to 40% bigger than expected for a chimpanzee of their body size, that they left behind modified quartz flakes and other tools. Fourth, skeletons, and that they left behind modified habilines, modified quartz flake different from the Australopithecines. Most important, hominids did not arrange their lives around the convenience of anthropologists. We are lucky that a rock can be carved into a cutter and that it lasts for millions of years, so some of our ancestors inadvertently left us time capsules. But it's much harder to carve a rock into a basket, a baby sling, a boomerang, or a bow and arrow. Contemporary hunter-gatherers use many self-composting implements for every lasting one, and that must be lasting one, and that must contemporary hunter-logical record is bound to underestimate tool use. So the standard timetable for human brain evolution begins the story too late. I think it also ends the story too early. Timetable for human brain evolution begins modern humans. Us, it's the story too late, 1,000 years ago in Africa. One kind of evidence is that the mitochondrial DNA, mDNA, of everyone on the planet, which is inherited only from one's mother, can be traced back to an African woman living sometime in that period. The claim is controversial, but the evidence is growing. Another thing sometime in that period is that anatomically modern fossils. The claim is controversial, and in the Middle East shortly afterward, around 90,000 years ago. The assumption is that human biological evolution had pretty much stopped then. This leaves an anomaly in the timeline. The anatomically modern early humans had the same toolkit and lifestyle as their doomed Neanderthal neighbors. Modern early humans had the same... The most dramatic change in the toolkit and lifestyle, also called the Great Leap Forward and the Human Revolution, had to wait another 50,000 years. Therefore, it is said, the human revolution must have been a cultural change. Calling it a revolution is no exaggeration. All other hominids come out of the comic strip B.C., but the Upper Paleolithic people were the Flintstones. More than 45,000 years ago, they somehow crossed 60 miles of open ocean to reach Australia, where they left behind hearths, cave paintings, the world's first polished tools, and today's Aborigines. Europe, home of the Cro-Magnons, and the Middle East also saw unprecedented art. Aborigines, ivory and bone, as well as stone, and technologies which used new materials and times transported hundreds of miles, like antler, needles, awls, many kinds of axes and scrapers, spear points, spear throwers, bows and arrows, fish hooks, engravers, flutes, maybe even calendars. They built shelters and they slaughtered large animals by the thousands. They decorated everything in sight, tools, cave walls, their bodies, and carved nick thousands. They decorated acts in the shapes of animals and naked women, everything in sight, these symbols. They were us. Ways of life certainly can shoot off without any biological change, as in the more recent agricultural, industrial, and information revolutions. That is especially true when populations grow to a point where the insights of thousands of inventors can be pooled. The first human revolution was not a cascade point where the insight. Ingenuity itself was the invention, manifested in hundreds of innovations, tens of thousands of miles and years apart. I find it hard to believe that the people of 100,000 years ago had the same minds as those of the upper Paleolithic revolutionaries to come, indeed the same minds as ours, and sat around for the upper Paleolithic revolutionaries 50,000 years without it dawning on to come, or without a single one feeling the urge to make anything look pretty. And there is no need to believe it. The 50,000-year gap is an illusion. First, the so-called anatomically modern humans of 100,000 years ago may have been more modern than their Neanderthal contemporaries, but no one would mistake them for contemporary humans. They had brow ridges, protruding faces, and heavily built skeletons outside the contemporary range. Their bodies had to evolve to become us, and their brains, us, and their brains, had the contemporary. The modern grew out of the habit of treating species labels as if they were real entities. When applied to evolving organisms, they are no more than a convenience. No one wants to invent a new species. Every applied to evolving organisms, they are no more time a tooth is found, so inter than a convenience category. The reality is that hominids must always have come in dozens or hundreds of variants, scattered across a large network of occasionally interacting subpopulations. The tiny fraction of individuals immortalized as fossils at any point were not necessarily our direct ancestors. The anatomically modern fossils, our close point, were not necessarily our direct end point, were not anyone else, but ancestors. Change. Second, the revolution probably began well before the commonly cited watershed of 40,000 years ago. That's when fancy artifacts begin to appear in European caves, but Europe has always attracted more attention than it deserves because it has lots of caves and lots of archaeologists. France alone has 300 well-excavated because it has lots of kings were scrubbed off by an overenthusiastic Boy Scout troop that mistook them for graffiti. The entire continent of Africa has only 24. But one in Zaire contains finely crafted bone implements, including daggers, shafts, and barbed points, together with grindstones brought from miles away and the remains of thousands of catfish, presumably the victims of these instruments. The collection looks post-revolutionary, but is dated at 75,000 years ago. One commentator said it was like finding a Pontiac in Leonardo da Vinci's attic. But as archaeologists are starting to explore this continental attic and date its Da Vinci's attic, fine stone blades, decorated tools, and they are finding more and more useless but colorful minerals Pontiacs. The mitochondrial Eve of 200,000 to 100,000 years ago was not a party to any evolutionary event. Contrary to some fantastic misunderstandings, she did not undergo some mutation that left her descendants smarter or more talkative or less brutish, nor did she mark the end of human evolution, left her descendants smarter or more. She is merely a talkative or lesser of all living people along the female, female, female line of great, 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 etc., great-grandmothers. For all the definition says, Eve could have been a fish. Eve, of course, turned out not to be a fish, but an African hominid. Why would anyone assume that she was a special hominid? Of course, turned out not to be a fish, but an hominid, or even that she lived in special times. African hominid, in places non-special. If 20th century Europeans and Asians mDNA is a variant of 200,000-year-old African mDNA, they must be descendants of an African population at the time. Eve's contemporary Europeans and Asians left no mDNA in today's Europeans and Asians. Eve's contemporary, and thus presumably were not their Europeans and Asians, not their all maternal line ancestors. But that says nothing about evolution's having stopped with Eve. We can assume that most evolution was done with by the time the ancestors of the modern races separated and stopped exchanging genes, since today we are birds of a feather. But that did not happen as soon as Eve breathed her last. The diaspora of the races and the end of significant human evolution must have occurred much later. Eve is not our most recent common ancestor, only our most recent common ancestor, only significant human evolution. The most recent common ancestor along a mixed-sex line of descendants lived much later. You and a first cousin share an ancestor of just two generations ago, your common grandmother, or you and a first cousin share grandfather. But in looking at an ancestor of just your mother's mother's mother and so on, then except for one kind of cousin, the child of your mother's sister, there's almost no limit to how far back you might have to go. So if someone were to guess the degree of relatedness between you and your cousin based on your most recent ancestor, he would say you were closely related. Relatedness between you and your cousin based related. But if he could check only the your most recent, you are not related at all. Similarly, the birthday of humanity's most recent common all-female line ancestor, mitochondrial Eve, overestimates how long ago all of humanity was still interbreeding. Well after Eve's day, some geneticists think, our ancestors passed through a... Well after population bottleneck, Eve's day, simple sameness of genes across modern human populations, around 65,000 years ago, our ancestors dwindled to a mere 10,000 people, perhaps because of global cooling triggered by a volcano in Sumatra. The human race was as endangered as mountain gorillas are today. The population then exploded in Africa and spun off small bands that moved to other corners of the world, possibly mating now and again with other early humans in their path. Many geneticists believe that evolution is especially rapid when scattered populations exchange occasional migrants. Natural selection can quickly adapt when scattered populations with any new challenge that arises, and their handy group to local conditions, so each group to be imported by the neighbors, one or more concoction of the human mind. All reconstructions of our evolutionary history are controversial, and the conventional wisdom changes monthly. But I predict that the closing date of our biological evolution will creep later, and the opening date of the archaeological revolution will creep earlier, until the action will creep later, and the open coincide. Our modern date of the arc. What now? Are we still evolving? Biologically, probably not much. Evolution has no momentum, so we will not turn into the creepy bloatheads of science fiction. The modern human condition is not conducive to real evolution either. We infest the whole habitable and the modern human condition is not conducive not so habitable Earth, migrate to real evolution. This makes us a nebulous moving target for natural selection. If the species is evolving at all, it is happening too slowly and unpredictably for us to know the direction. But Victorian hopes spring eternal. If genuine natural selection cannot improve us, maybe a human-made substitute can. The social... If genuine natural selection cannot... Sciences are filled with claims that new can improve us, maybe a human... But the claims, I think, are misleading. The first claim is that the world contains a wonderful process called adaptation that causes organisms to solve problems. Now, in Darwin's strict sense, adaptation in the present is caused by selection in the past. Remember how natural selection gives an illusion of teleology. Selection may look like it is adapting each organism to its needs in the present, but really it is just favoring the descendants of organisms. Selection may look like it is adapting each organism to its needs and minds among our ancestors, got passed down to build the innate bodies and minds of today, including innate abilities to track certain kinds of environmental variation, as in tanning, callousing, including innate abilities and learning. Track certain kinds of daily. Darwinian social scientists, such as Paul Turk and Laura Betzig, believe that modern Darwinian theory predicts that human behavior will be adaptive, that is, designed to promote maximum reproductive success through available descendant and non-descendant relatives. Through available discussionalists, such as the psychologist and non, they view the selectional processes operating during evolution and the selectional processes operating during learning as part of one seamless natural fabric. The implication is that there is no need for specialized mental machinery. If adaptation simply makes organisms do the right thing, who could ask for anything more? The problem with functionalism is that it is Lamarckian. The problem with functionalism is that it is Lamarckian. Not in the sense of Lamarck's second principle, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, the giraffes who stretched their necks and begat baby giraffes with necks pre-stretched. Everyone knows to stay away from that. Well, almost everyone. Freud and Piaget stuck to it long after it was abandoned by biologists. It is Lamarckian in the sense of his first principle. Rowing their necks when they hungrily eyed the leaves just out of reach. As Lamarck put it, needs which establish a necessity for some part really bring about the existence of that part as a result of effort. If only it were so, some part, others would ride. There are no guardian angels seeing to it that every need is met. Wishes were horses, beg organ that meets the need. When the organism finds itself in an environment in which meeting the need translates into more surviving babies, and in which that selection pressure persists over thousands of generations, otherwise, the need not grow webbed fingers. Eskimos do not grow fur. I have studied three-dimensional mirror images for 20 years, and though I know mathematically that you can convert a left shoe into a right shoe by turning it around in the fourth dimension, I have been unable to grow a 4D mental space in which to visualize the flip. Felt need is an alluring idea. Needs really do feel like they bring forth their own solutions. You're hungry, you have hands, the food's in front of you. Your brain was fashioned by natural selection so that it would find such problems obvious. Change the mind to a robot's or to another animal's or to a neurological patient's, or change the mind to arrange the problem and it's no longer so obvious, robots or to drop a piece of food for a larger reward. When chimpanzees try to imitate someone raking in an inaccessible snack, they don't notice that the rake has to be held business end down, even if the role model makes a conspicuous show of aligning it properly. Lest you feel smug, the chapters to come will show how the design conspicuous show of aligning it properly. Our own minds gives rise to irrationalities and self-defeating strategies that prevent rather than guarantee the meat of our everyday needs. But what about the Darwinian imperative to survive and reproduce? As far as day-to-day behavior is concerned, there is no such imperative. People watch pornography when they could be seeking a mate. Forgo food to buy heroin. Postpone childbearing to climb the corporate ladder and eat themselves into an early grave. Human vice is proof that biological adaptation is, speaking literally, a thing of the past. Our minds are adapted to the small foraging bands in which our family spent 99% of its existence, not to the topsy-turvy contingencies we have created since the agricultural and industrial revolutions. Before there was photography, it was adaptive to receive visual images of attractive members of the opposite sex, because those images arose only from light reflecting off fertile bodies. Before opiates came in syringes, it was adaptive to witness people's emotional struggles because Before there was contraception, children were unpostponable, and status and wealth could be converted into more children and healthier ones. Before there was a sugar bowl, salt shaker, and butter dish on every table, and when lean years were never far away, one could never get too much sweet, salty, and fatty food. People do not divine what is adaptive. One could never get too much sweet for them or their genes, salty, and fatty environment in which the genes were selected. The other extension of adaptation is the seemingly innocuous cliché that cultural evolution has taken over from biological evolution. For millions of years, genes were transmitted from body to body and were selected to confer adaptations on organisms. But after humans emerged, transmitted from body and were selected to confer adaptations on cultures. The torch of progress had been passed to a swifter runner. In 2001, A Space Odyssey, a hairy arm hurls a bone into the air and it fades into a space station. The premise of cultural evolution is that there is a single phenomenon, station. The march of progress, the ascent of man, that Darwin explained only up to a point. My own view is that human brains evolved by one set of laws, those of natural selection and genetics, and now interact with one another according to other sets of laws, those of cognitive and social psychology, human ecology, and history. The reshaping of the skull and the rise and fall of empires may have little in common. Richard Dawkins has drawn the clearest analogy between the selection of genes and the selection of bits of culture. Richard Dawkins has drawn the clearest analogy from brain to brain and sometimes mutate in the transmission. New features of a meme that make its recipients more likely to retain and disseminate it, such as being catchy, seductive, funny, or a meme that make its recipients more likely to refutable, will lead to the meme to retain and disseminate. In subsequent rounds of retelling, the most spread-worthy memes will spread the most and will eventually take over the population. Ideas will therefore evolve to become better adapted to spreading themselves. Note that we are talking about ideas evolving to become more spreadable, not people evolving to become more knowledgeable. About ideas evolving to become more... Dawkins himself used the analogy spreadable, not people can replicate, not just DNA. Others treat it as a genuine theory of cultural evolution. Taken literally, it predicts that cultural evolution works like this. A meme impels its bearer to broadcast it, and it mutates in some recipient. A sound, a word, or a phrase is randomly altered. Perhaps mutates in some recipient. Perhaps, as in Monty Python's Life of a sound, a word, blessed are the peacemakers, as blessed are the cheesemakers. The new version is more memorable and comes to predominate in the majority of minds. It, too, is mangled by typos and speakos and heroes, and the most spreadable ones accumulate, gradually transforming the sequence of sounds. Eventually, they spell out, "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." End of side 4. Please turn to side 5.